You may have heard of the term strategic land, but do you actually know what it is? And what does someone who works in strategic land actually do? Well, you're about to find out.
I think that unless you have experience or knowledge of strategic land, even if you are in the industry, there's quite a lack of knowledge in some circumstances of actually what we do. Gone out and driven round a district or a local authority and you thought and looked at the maps and the planning documents and actually said, you know, I think that site looks like it's got potential, and as Ben said, you then progress with deal terms and planning and to see houses built on the site, I would have thought is extremely rewarding.
You're listening to EG's Tomorrow's Leaders podcast. I'm Rebecca Kent. Today we speak to Ben Coles and James Mallion, who are part of the UK-wide team that make up the Strategic Land Department at the house-building giant Taylor Wimpey. Taylor Wimpey this year launches a graduate program which places candidates into permanent positions at the end of a two-year scheme. The aim is to bring young blood into what is undoubtedly one of the most important parts of the business.
If for talented individuals, the company will go out of their way to look after them, to make sure that they have the right opportunities.
Now carry on listening and we'll dig deep into the details of Stratland.
I think we're finding that we're using more and more political consultants and community engagement consultants because they're good at what they do. They know they've got good contacts in certain districts and they can actually gauge what the true opinion is. You can often find that the people that shout the loudest, that's the opinion that you think is the correct one, but actually when you dig a little bit deeper and have professionals that are good at doing that, you actually find what the true beliefs are in a certain local authority and whether a certain site, for example, has got better potential than what is the sort of rumour going around, I guess.
You'll also hear EG's residential correspondent, Alex Peace, throw some testing questions into the mix.
Which causes the most delays, newts or bats?
But as ever, it's not a Tomorrow's Leaders podcast until we uncover the true characters behind the microphone. You've got a few tricks up your sleeve, don't you?
I do.
I am a trained barrister. It can actually be quite useful if you misspell it on a CV because people actually think you're a barrister.
So, do you do that deliberately
not
sometimes?
Not use that one, no, but I can do a decent flat white.
This is EG's Tomorrow's Leaders podcast, presented by Rebecca Kent. My sidekick today is Alex Peace, EG's residential correspondent. And in the studio with us today are a couple of gentlemen from the Strategic Land Division of Taylor Wimpey, Ben Coles, Regional Director, and James Mallion, Assistant Land Manager. Thanks very much for joining us. Welcome.
Morning.
Thank you.
So Taylor Wimpey is one of the UK's biggest house builders. Last year, building nearly 14,000 homes. Since then, of course, we've seen Brexit and a general election, which has caused some upheaval for everyone, for the entire sector, of course. But there is a very big role for Taylor Wimpey to play in delivering the government's target of 1 million new homes by 2020. But before we get into the serious talk, I think we should try and get to know our guests a little bit better. So, Ben, why don't we start with you? You're not just a strategic land guru. You've got a few tricks up your sleeve, don't you?
I do. I am a trained barrister. It can actually be quite useful if you misspell it on a CV because people actually think you're a barrister.
Do you do that deliberately
sometimes?
Not use
that one, no, but I can do a decent flat white.
I bet the tea rounds are fun in your office.
Yes, it tends to be rather infrequent, though, I'm afraid.
And you've just, I understand you've also got your car racing licence.
Yes, new thing this year. Much agitation from the wife, I'm afraid, but yes. So I've now got my ARDS license, which means I can go and hoon around racetracks at the weekend, keeping everyone excited at the back of the grid at the moment.
And where do you sit in the rankings of car races in the UK?
You get me on this one. So there was some statistics published about a month ago, and I think I'm about six races into my fledgling career, generally toying around at the back of the grid. And so I think out of about 6,000 national amateur drivers, I'm pretty much near the back end, sort of 5,000 something or other. So much to play for.
Baby steps, Ben.
Absolutely.
And because racing and coffee making is not enough to squeeze into your weekends, you also have another little sideline.
Oh, yes. A little secret of mine. I do some DJing on the side as well. So that's fun. Keeps neighbours awake and available for bar mitzvahs and general parties and things. So I'll give you my email address later.
Is this the modern form of DJing, sort of Spotify playlist?
No, I mix some vinyl, sort of a bit old school there, and generally sort of play house music, and I suppose most things are going digital these days, but I still try and play vinyl when I possibly can do.
And James, you play the trumpet.
I play the trumpet, not well at all, but I can say that I can play the trumpet. So that's, I suppose, one thing to add to the CV, yeah.
What's your favourite tune?
Oh, goodness. I used to do a good Match of the Day theme tune. I think that was, I'd say that was my best attempt at playing the trumpet.
All right. Now let's crack on with the serious stuff. Probably worth just asking the question, what is strategic land? How do you define it?
Well, from a company point of view, I think the strict definition of strategic land for us is land which doesn't have any planning, so it doesn't have any planning consent. You know, that can be for a variety of forms. I suppose generally the type of opportunity which we tend to focus on are greenfield housing extensions. But there are numerous examples of sort of other sites as well. Some can be brownfield, mostly greenfield, as I say. Different scales from, I don't know, probably the smallest sites we're dealing with at the moment, maybe even 10 units to many thousand. But for us, it all boils down to the planning. So at the point of us taking a legal interest in the site, there is no planning status. Our focus thereafter is actually securing a planning status, delivering the planning consent, and ultimately building the site. So that's pretty much in a nutshell how we see strategic land working.
In terms of timescales, it could be as little as, you know, 2 years up to 20 plus years.
Absolutely.
That we are promoting a site. So at the moment, for example, a lot of local plans are at the stage where they're allocating sites, and some of these still class as strategic, I would say. So there's some that we're pursuing there, but equally there's others that require a much longer promotion, which could be, as I said, up to 20 odd years.
And where are these sites? Where's your focus geographically?
Well, we've got a national presence, so we have three divisions nationwide between a northern region, Wales West, East and Central, which is part of the team which I sit within, and London and South East, which is where James is based. And each of those, so we each have a pipeline of sites which we manage, and also a pipeline of sites which we try to acquire and bring into the business. And really the focus for the business in acquiring new sites is very much based about sort of planning providence and also quality of location. That applies to both strategic land and short-term land. So if we're looking to purchase land in the short-term market, probably with a form of planning consent, then again, it all comes down to quality of location. So that's probably the number one criteria for us going forward.
Do you look for land that's exclusively in local plans, or do you go across the piece almost?
I'd say at the moment, because of where we sit within having we have about 100,000 strategic land plots within our pipeline at the moment, number of those going through a planning system. But I think because we're fairly well established within the sector, we have the opportunity to look more strategic. So I think the real focus is actually trying to ensure that sites within our pipeline are actually allocated. That's a real focus, that planning promotion activity. But it's a nice opportunity to actually look at, I'd say, traditional strategic land of next plan allocations, greenbelt releases, that type of thing. I think over the last 4 or 5 years in particular, there's been a lot of, I'd call it pseudo-strat land, a lot of five-year housing land supply agreements contrived, many of which we've run ourselves. But there's a degree of opportunism in terms of that approach to securing planning. And I think as local authorities start to get to grips with their local plans, and they start to come to fruition, then that more opportunistic nature is is going to diminish, and proper plan making is where we are focused at the moment.
Much of the in my patch, for example, most of the land is greenbelt, so we're finding that, you know, if it's with the current policy.
What is your patch?
My patch, I cover Berkshire, South Buckinghamshire, and West Hertfordshire. So as you can imagine, there's not a huge amount of land around, and if there is any, then it is in the greenbelt, more likely than not. So we're finding that with the policy where it is at the moment, we're having to promote it through the local plan or having to gain an allocation in order to get a planning application in, and we can't take the sort of speculative 5-year housing land supply approach to submitting applications.
I mean, on a purely hypothetical situation, say you had a plot for 100 units in the local plan but it wasn't very suitable, or a plot for 100 units outside the local plan which was much more suitable for housing itself, which one would you take? Is it one or the other?
Suitable for housing because it's got a draft status, as opposed to...
Suitable for housing because it's just a better site. You know, it would work better, it's in a better location, etc., etc., but it's not in the local plan.
I think the honest answer is we would probably promote the site which had had status. It's a lot of variants which apply to that sentiment, though. I think it very much depends on what stage you're in the local plan. If it's very advanced and you've got limited opportunity to influence on that potentially perceived better site, then I think to some degree you accept the inevitable that that site is going to be developed, and look at actually how it could be best developed. It may well be, if we're talking about purely strategic land, that site, I think at that stage it's maybe unlikely that someone wouldn't have a position on it potentially. So I think if we came to that local plan afresh and we're looking at those two sites, then I'd be saying the better of the two, which is not allocated, would be something which we would be better at securing a position on. It's that ability to take a longer term view, manage it, and work with the local authority to bring something through which meets everyone's objectives.
And the political nature of plan making is huge, because, you know, you find that in the early stages of a local plan preparation, sites may be in one moment, and then say an election happens, and you might find that a historically Labour controlled area, it was forcing housing towards the maybe Conservative parts of the district, and then, you know, there's a switch change, and you find that the opposite happens. So you might have a site that actually isn't in the early stages of the emerging plan, but then it comes in once a political change has occurred. So you've always got sites that might not be in at the moment, but have great opportunities and potential, and you've just got to pursue them, I think, if you think they've got a good chance.
I think it goes without saying, we're in an environment at the moment where nationally there is a great emphasis on delivery, and we're probably in no better planning environment in terms of bringing sites forward. But notwithstanding that, from a local aspect, and certainly when you're working on sites and having to deal with not the national aspect, but local policies and local politics, we still do operate in a planning constrained environment. So I think we always look at every opportunity on its merits. I think that probably sums things up.
I mean, let's talk about politics. How much of an impact, and you know, planning and risks around planning, it's a notoriously sort of convoluted process, you know, to navigate. What impact does that have on your day-to-day decision making?
I think we're finding that we're using more and more political consultants and community engagement consultants, because they're good at what they do. They know they've got good contacts in certain districts, and they can actually gauge what the true opinion is. You can often find that the people that shout the loudest, that's the opinion that you think is the correct one. But actually, when you dig a little bit deeper and have professionals that are good at doing that, you actually find what the true beliefs are in a certain local authority, and whether a certain site, for example, has got better potential than what is the sort of rumour going around, I guess.
Who are these consultants? Who are these professionals you're looking to for help?
I'm not going to give any game away in terms of necessarily which consultants we're using. But I mean, I think despite what James says in terms of actually using consultants, I'd say we use consultants where we feel it's necessary.
So these are people who know the localised political landscape.
Absolutely. So yeah. They may be former politicians or maybe existing politicians, but nevertheless,
Always good to have their number in your black book.
Utilising their expertise to at least get an introduction is the real focus. I think where in a perfect world, and it's clearly not, but we will try and make our own endeavours to engage. And Taylor Wimpey is really committed to that, and we've seen the benefits of it. Our approach in an ideal world is to go along to both the local authority and ideally the town council and talk about a blank piece of paper. So we have this site, we'd like to build some houses on it, and we'd like to understand what that site can help to deliver for the local community. That's probably one of the key challenges we face, because I think from the point of view of embracing change, whether that's sort of locally, nationally, or whatever, that's something which can be quite a difficult ordeal for individuals to contemplate. And so, again, it's that approach to pause, understand what it is which we can help to achieve, and understand actually what the issues for the area may well be, whether it's perceived or there are maybe highway issues, and what can our site, our approach, help to deliver. So, often it can be affordable housing. It's really understanding what the needs and aspirations locally are. You don't always win the hearts and minds, but it can certainly help.
What do you think your chief skill is, or your chief area's expertise? Are you a land buyer or a planner? Or a community engagement type as well, actually, I suppose, is the other side of it. I mean, what do you think the key skill is to being a strategic land department these days?
Punching question, God, Alex.
That is punching for Friday morning. I mean, if I look at my team, and I suppose me, we've all got specialties. We generally, either from a planning background, land agency, surveying, or project management. I think when you come into a strategic land team, that's generally a good place to start. And in being in a team environment, it's good because we feed off each other. If I've got an issue on planning, I'm not a planner, so I will consult with one of my learned planning colleagues, and that's really how it should work, that engagement. But I think in actually doing our role and promoting sites and taking them through a plan-led system, you have to really understand a bit about everything. So you have to understand the legal contracts, the basis of how that works. You have to understand the planning system and the opportunities that presents. So I think to answer your question, in an ideal world, we would be a rounded character, understanding all aspects of the role. That's a rubbish answer, I appreciate that.
But if we're approaching a landowner, they want to know that not only do we know the legal contract side, but we also are comfortable in the planning status at the moment of their land and the planning position in their district, that and we know we have a good strategy in place that we think can release their land and we can start building houses on it. So yeah, as Ben said, you do have to have sort of rounded knowledge of all aspects to be sort of in this strategic land department, I would say.
Surely pressures to deliver makes that negotiation perhaps slightly easier?
Every site's individual and every landowner's individual. I think from our point of view, we'll always present a case and a strategy as to how we would see that site coming forward. Or not as the case may be. It's often we'll be meeting landowners who have asked us to consider their land, and unfortunately we don't think it's a credible opportunity, and at that point we'll wish them well and keep in contact, no doubt. It's a tricky one in that respect.
What about from the corporate side? Do you find yourselves under quite a lot of pressure to continue to expand the land bank? I mean, by its size, Taylor Wimpey's got, I think, the largest land bank of any commercial developer, and obviously the analyst and the business model loves that because it shows the pipeline. Do you just find yourselves under a lot of pressure to keep refilling that each year, basically?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. I think at the moment, I was just in anticipation today, we're having a quick talk, James and I, about the current land bank. I think we sit at 76,000 consented plots, which is sounds like a lot, but it's pretty much 5 years supply for us as a company. You overlay that with what we call our strategic land pipeline, and as you say, it is the largest by way of sector, and I think we do have the largest strategic land bank by way of any other house builders. I'd invite you to come and sit in with some of our monthly meetings where we look at what's happening with each of the sites and how we can take these forward, and every energy is spent towards trying to unlock and release these opportunities to deliver them. So it's, it's a conundrum which the industry is grappling with at the moment. As I say, our biggest challenge within our team generally is planning, decision making. Sometimes you'd say rogue decision making, whereby you're taking sites to committee with a recommendation from an officer, and decisions get overturned. And unfortunately, that's becoming part of the job now. So delays, and I've got a number of examples, unfortunately, from the last couple of years where that type of example has happened. And ultimately, we've still got planning, but matters have been delayed for probably, in all honesty, 12 to 18 months, and additional costs involved in that. And you know, with regards to the company, our key raw material is land. So, and you could argue that in making such decisions, whereby we end up having to contest sites through the appeal route and inevitable delays, we have to look at other opportunities as well. So it's a case of we have to buy land to exist as a company. We procure strategic land for many, many reasons, but one of the key ones really is being able to manage that land supply coming through the company. You can see it coming for a number of years, you manage it, and ultimately you nurture it in the way which the company wants to achieve it. And so you know, that's one of the sort of key strengths of actually bringing the strategic land through the system.
How big are the sites?
They range vastly. You know, as Ben said earlier, it could be as small as a 10-unit scheme that is in a very high value area, and the returns are good on it compared to several thousand sites. We may be in a consortium with other developers and bringing forward a huge, possibly even new settlement or a major extension to a town or city in the country. So it completely ranges, and every site is different, and every site has different complexities that you've got to get round, and trying to put the best site forward when you put a planning application in is the real aim, really.
Mm. And is the aim to sort of master plan a site and then, you know, perhaps sell off parcels of it, or how do you
very, very much site dependent, really, because quite clearly that there are market factors to understand and anticipate. Now on a site of maybe 150 units, you'd maybe argue that's a 3-year production cycle for us. Quite manageable, I'd say, an almost an ideal opportunity. You know, you multiply that opportunity by sort of tenfold, and you're talking maybe about a 1,500 housing development scheme. And there's an awful lot more infrastructure generally which goes into actually delivering such sites. And it's not just housing, it's schools, it's community facilities and so on. And in those scenarios, it does become more of a business plan, really, in terms of actually how we go about delivering and securing that. And so our key focus is building houses in you know, good, sustainable locations. But the delivery mechanism for that can be infinite, whether or not that first spade in the ground anticipates a huge sort of highway infrastructure improvements or not, as the case may be. And so we'll look at each and every opportunity to either service parcels, bring on other house builders, and as James says, I mean, a number of our sites are consortium sites, working with other house builders or land promoters.
There was quite a retreat by the big house builders after the recession from the large strategic master planning sites. Does Taylor Wimpey still do any of that, and what's the largest almost you'd go for?
Well, personal experience in the moment, and probably, I mean, if we say sort of post-recession, we've been working on a number of sites pre, during and post-recession for the same objective, to try and secure planning consent on them. So I can think of a number of sites of, you know, the likes of Camborne, new settlement 25 years ago, enormous great big greenfield, it's now got 4,500 houses on it, you know, with all the community facilities, town council and so on to go with that, and we're planning for another 2,300 houses on as an extension. So I suppose to answer your question, I think we paused and really did consider how we deliver these sites, with a particular focus on that upfront infrastructure and really sort of cash flow being a sort of key objective I think all the house builders at the moment. But we're fully committed to sites of a scale. And as I say, at the moment, we're promoting sites of 2,000 units. We've got an application in our site at the moment for 4,500 houses. So scale, it's biggest isn't always best, and it does create issues, but we're certainly fully committed to sites of that scale.
What are the challenges challenges and opportunities in London compared to outside of London?
I think on a strategic level, it's difficult to find a strategic site, even in the outer London boroughs, some of which I cover, but colleagues, for example, are doing extensive analysis work of London boroughs and are finding that, okay, there may be some strategic opportunities, but the majority is more immediate side. So I'm not sure if we can really comment on the London market, because it's something that we don't really get involved in as much as those that specialise it in up in the city. But externally, there's plenty of opportunities still in the strategic land world, and there's always, it's how long you want to look. Next plan period or further on, it depends how much of a risk and how good you think a site is in the longer term, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably worth saying at the moment, clearly we're talking about strategic land today, that's what James and I do as a day job. At the moment, about 51% of our completions come via strategic land sources, which is really just where the company wants to be. I think that the medium term target is about 40%. If we roll back probably 5-6 years ago, then it was certainly below that figure. So it's all paying dividends in that respect. But that still means that we're buying sites within the short-term land market as well. And I think London would be a prime example of that, whereby strategic land, if we were to define, go by our definition of land which doesn't have planning consent, there aren't as many opportunities as there are elsewhere. So that's where we would focus, certainly. If you listen to any of the statements from Pete Redfern over the last 3-4 years, then strategic land is front and centre of those announcements. The objective to secure 40%, as I say, is a medium-term aspiration, and I think as a team, both locally and nationally, we're set up to achieve that at the moment. I think with that comes various challenges. We have the largest strategic land portfolio within the sector, as we say. I think we've also got the largest strategic land team with vast experience, but actually with that comes challenges in terms of succession planning and the like. And I think if we look back again 2-3 years ago and look at the average maybe age profile and sort of diversity of the team, it was a relatively mature in years. That's substantially changed and changing, and it's certainly an area where I think the company in appreciating that being a risk for us going forward, wants to bring in new blood and new ideas as well. So that's really the focus for why, as you may or may not be aware, we've got a long-term graduate intake and graduate program. And I think this year is the first year we've actually had a designated strategic land program, which I think we're all really excited about.
And you were talking about the graduate program, James. Tell us about how you ended up.
Yeah, so I mean, I graduated with a geography degree in 2015, and was looking to get into the property industry somehow. My father is in the building industry, and so I suppose I'd always been immersed in that. And I was interested to seek opportunities, but I didn't have a path that I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. I was very coming in with a broad outlook. So, I mean, I saw the Taylor Wimpey graduate scheme, the rotational scheme across the company, and I applied for that role. And then throughout the sort of the process of interviews, they said, we've actually got this strategic land graduate role that we are trialling and think you would be suited to that. So that's how I then got into the strategic land area and really enjoy it. I think it's a great part of the industry that some people don't know a lot about, but it, as Ben said, it brings huge value to the companies and is crucial in the land market in the industry. So for me, I would start by doing land searches of districts, for example, and gradually was brought into different planning applications, or would go to public consultation events or meet landowners, a huge spectrum of things to gain experience. And I think that is what now this new graduate scheme for strategic land is looking to bring forward as well, is that focus on giving you a breadth of a view of the strategic land industry.
And what were some of the, I mean, what was the information you lacked before you came in into the strategic land department? What were some, what were the sort of the questions, what were your preconceptions or your misconceptions?
Well, I lacked planning knowledge. I didn't have any knowledge of the planning system, how it worked. So it was very much starting from scratch and learning as much as I can about it. There's so many different quirks and small details that you need to know, and you can't be expected to know that immediately. So I think that by giving you experience and sitting in meetings and generally getting as much exposure as you can has been a huge benefit, and I think that's what they're looking to do now as well.
So how many graduates are coming through the program, or what's the goal?
This year the ideal intake is 8, so that we've got ideas in terms of where they want them to be based nationally, a number in Scotland, our Yorkshire and North East regions. Hopefully I'm getting one in my region as well, all things being equal.
And what are the prerequisite qualifications?
We're looking ideally for people who have got property-based degrees, whether that's property or planning. And the ideal applicants would also have a degree which was accredited by either the RTPI or RICS, as the case may be. And the basis for that is we're wanting to give those candidates support during their sort of initial 2 years within the company to actually go forward and become chartered. That's again another way. It's a new thing for Taylor Wimpey. It's not something which we've done with, I think, where individuals have sought that accreditation. It's been on more of a sort of an individual basis. That's the intention, certainly.
Great. And I understand, Ben, you've acted as sort of a mentor for James.
Ben was more than happy for me to ask him questions when I first joined, and I spent some time with him and his team learning about their sites and whether it be new land that we were bringing in or planning applications that we were putting together. So I think for me, because I didn't have a huge knowledge of the industry before joining, it was key that the team were willing to answer any questions I had, and Ben will probably say that I pestered him too much, but I think that's the only way that you can learn, really, if people are willing to give you pass on their knowledge and teach. So
what were the questions? I mean, just give us an example of some of the stuff you find yourself feeling
commercial sensitive
about.
We couldn't possibly
Whether it's certain aspects of an option agreement, for example, certain legal jargon that can be confusing. I think that is something that is difficult to get your head around at the start. On the other hand, I suppose issues relating to planning, how is the best to submit this application, what different consultant work goes into it, what is needed. It's just
it's probably worth saying. I mean, I think we've got specialists within all different fields within the various teams, and each of them, I've witnessed it firsthand, are more than happy to spend time and act as a mentoring role to graduates coming through the system. Everyone sees the benefit of it ultimately, and the ideal is that we operate on a fairly sort of flat management structure, and there's a great deal of autonomy put in the individual's hands. And you know, ultimately, I think as James has progressed through the system and taken more responsibility and ownership, and ultimately that comes with a degree of experience as well, become more confident in decision making. Because I think with regards to our sort of day to day, every day is a challenge in some way, shape, or form. You come up against new challenges, issues, and it's really being confident and understanding as to what the right thing to do is at that point, both for the site and also for the company. And it's always going to come with a degree of experience. And I think the challenge really, I suppose, for me as a manager is entrusting my team to be happy to make those decisions. but also not be scared of actually asking questions when they're run short, and so that knowledge base exists for that very purpose.
Tell us about the consultation process.
In terms of planning?
Yeah.
Yep.
I think there's sort of an emphasis for developers to be a lot more transparent and open with the public. Are you finding that that's the sort of pressure that's coming through, and how are you responding?
Taylor Wimpey have been committed to this, not just in text, but by our actions for a number of years now. And we've seen the benefits of it as well. And it's enormously rewarding managing a site, both from a point of view of identifying an opportunity, meeting up with the local authority and also the town council, going through a consultation event. And those events will ultimately influence what it is we're proposing on the site. Sometimes there's areas where we can compromise, sometimes there aren't. But actually, I think where we're very good is trying to be honest about what it is we can and can't do. And I think that sort of stems back to an awful lot of work which we deal with it, whether it's internally or externally. It's about that degree of honesty and keeping promises. So we've got a number of areas where we're successfully developing at the moment, and you know a lot of that comes from both trust and delivering on those promises. So we've got our planning consents, we've dealt with our pre-commencement conditions, we're now delivering on site. That's really what the local authority wants. They don't want to be granting consent and effectively being sat there mothballed for a number of years thereafter. Success on that basis breeds, I think, future success in those areas as well. Again, that confidence and delivery aspect.
And are there any sort of common grievances or points that you find yourself dealing with across the board with local authorities?
Well, if I was going to generalise, I'd say highways would always be an issue for most sites which we bring forward, whether that's perceived or technically an issue. And that's a challenge for us, particularly when it comes to engaging at a local level. So, you know, at that point in time, we may be meeting in a public environment, maybe a village hall, trying to present some ideas. And the perception locally is that one additional house here would be the end of the world in terms of the traffic congestion. And that's really, that's what we have to respond to. And ultimately, it's something which we don't always agree on. There are often technical solutions which, from a layperson's perspective, don't appear to be something which would help to deliver the scheme or appease local congestion. Again, I suppose to some degree we are reliant upon our transport advisors in that case, but also them getting agreement with the county council in respect to those sorts of issues. So I think that's a very sort of technical answer, I suppose, to that point. But you know, if you think about the numerous comments we'll get back on public in public consultations and forms and so on, everything above really, it can be quite a lot to take in.
And there might be certain not issues, but issues in certain areas, like I don't know whether it be ecology or there's protected trees or things like that that the public feels very strongly about, or for public footpaths, for example, and every site's different. You have to try and incorporate that into your scheme and try and show how you are, you know, working with the public and trying to deliver the best scheme that benefits everybody in that community. So,
And I think rumour mill is one of the problems, isn't it?
You know, right.
Before we know it, Taylor Wimpey are coming along and building however many houses on this lovely, nice, flat, green field, which might or might not flood in some instances. Isn't it? And it's just trying to dispel those rumours and myths and be honest about what it is we're trying to do. And in response to that sort of example I've just given, you know, we're not trying to build on the floodplain. We're planning an appropriate development which doesn't have issues in respect of that. So, it comes down to that sort of honest approach, and I think that works. I think from our point of view, it's nice that we try and nurture relationships at a senior level within local authorities, but also from a political point of view as well. Mm. No doubt, I have a great deal of sympathy when it comes to local members and politicians when we may stir up a hornet's nest and then maybe not appropriately briefed. So that's something which we'd always try and go out of our way to make sure they're the first ones to hear about what we're doing.
Which causes the most delays, newts or bats?
Oh.
Good question.
Well, say delays, we tend to know about it fairly on in the process, so it's probably a delay we've already allowed for in an ideal world. It doesn't always happen that way.
Great answer. You're
plan delays.
Ahead of the game. Ben, how did you get into your role?
Good. I've been with Taylor Wimpey now since... I've been with Taylor Woodrow and then Wimpey since 2004. I graduated in 2002 and joined a regional developer in Yorkshire at the time, and I was approached about a move to work in the immediate land team in Taylor Woodrow. I thought that was a good opportunity, so went with it. That was great, actually, because I think in the early 2000s, particularly in the Yorkshire land market and Leeds in particular, it was a very, very, very competitive area. Lots of house builders scrapping over not an awful lot of land. So it was a good area to sort of cut one's teeth, so to speak. And then I think after that, I moved into strategic land in about 2006, 2007. So that was just before the merger. I think I saw, it completely passed me by, but I saw Taylor Wimpey's 10 years old this year. Post-merger and post-recession, I think like a lot of companies, there's also an awful lot of consolidation and soul-searching, and I think we came out on the other end and have been onwards and upwards ever since, really. So I've moved regions within the company, from the Yorkshire region to work more recently within the what we call sort of the Eastern and Central Division, sort of overseeing likes of authorities in Oxfordshire, South Midlands, East Anglia, and over in East Midlands as well. I've really enjoyed every I would say every day, but most days certainly. It's been a real challenge, and every day is different. I think that's one of the beauties about strategic land. I think if you look at our, I'm sure James is saying, if you look at our diaries from one week to the next, there's certainly a lack of consistency. I think you'd probably argue that the job and role itself, it has to be quite reactionary. You know, we're always reacting to issues as we're confronted. You like to think we're fairly strategic in our sort of decision making at the same time, but it's very much a case of having to deal with what confronts you on a daily basis.
I was going to ask you five things, and I think I'd ask you to prepare this five things that people may not know about strategic land. I feel like we may have covered it all off. But do you find there's a question people always ask you and you have a sort of ready-made answer for? Or is there something you say to make it sound a little bit more sexy than it actually is?
I think generally people just say, what is strategic land? I think that unless you have experience or knowledge of strategic land, even if you are in the industry, there's quite a lack of knowledge in some circumstances of actually what we do. So yeah, as we've sort of explained earlier, it's identifying sites and promoting them through the planning process to hopefully achieve a consent. So that's in essence what we do. But I would say the most common question is, what exactly is strategic land? So
the other aspects in terms how strategic land works within Taylor Wimpey in particular, I mean, as I say, it's front and centre of our strategy. I think James, you'll sit in divisional board meetings on a quarterly basis, which is attended by our divisional chairman, and there's a great deal of exposure that the entire land team and also graduates coming forward get from that. So that the divisional chairman taking time out of his day on a very regular basis to review the portfolio, review what's going on, and it's a great opportunity to actually to get some personal exposure within the company as well. And as I mentioned earlier about sort of the relatively flat management structure, it's not uncommon, and I've seen examples of managing directors ringing up some of our graduate team with a genuine question. They've been dealing with a unique example of might be a rather tricky contract quite recently, and are wanting to understand what their thoughts are. So it's great. There's such a diverse range of experience and I suppose attitudes going forward. I think that, to come back to it, that's really what we're trying to achieve in terms of this graduate intake. It's fresh ideas. I think the company itself, I think it's always prided itself on some degree of diversity and being innovative in terms of their decision making and process going forward. And Stratland, in its very nature, is entrepreneurial, you know, in terms of its deal construction, how you go about sorting planning issues, I couldn't recommend it enough.
I think that's what I've found, that flat management structure within the company has been great for my learning in the 2 years that I've been with the company, and coming in and being relatively inexperienced in not only the working world but the industry itself, being able to sit down with senior management has been great for my personal development, and not being afraid to actually put your point across in a meeting with the board members, for example, and talking about a site that you are progressing and the different points with the deal and with the planning aspects. So I think that's a really great thing about the company, is that the younger members of the team shouldn't be afraid to actually put their point forward and say what they think needs to be said.
Mm-hmm. And I think on that there's also a huge amount of personal pride that comes with, take James's role for instance, identifying a site, securing a contract on it, delivering planning, and actually seeing a start building on site. That's really, you know,
even if it does take years.
Well, sometimes it does take years, but actually the fact of the matter is, I suppose it's an awful lot of your hard work, and you've spotted this opportunity, and ultimately. A number of planning committee members have also thought this is a good idea, and let's get going with it.
Yeah, I think that is a very rewarding part of the job, that you've gone out and driven round a district or a local authority and you've thought and looked at the maps and the planning documents and actually said, I think that site looks like it's got potential, and as Ben said, you then progress with deal terms and planning and to see houses built on the site. I would have thought is extremely rewarding. Mm. So that's one good thing about, not one good thing, that is a very good thing about strategic land. Yeah.
So you're looking for grads, or your grad program is open at the moment? When do you
ongoing,
start recruiting?
Ongoing at the moment, as far as I understand. I think we're internally we're in the final stages of actually just refining the actual program itself, looking at how the rotation scheme is going to work. And I suppose just to give us sort of a slight insight in terms of how I think we see that working going forward, the idea really is to make sure that by the end of a 2 year structured program, there's an awful lot of experience derived from both working within the strategic land team, negotiating, managing projects, but also, and I'd say probably even more so, about the company itself. So there's going to be opportunities to work within sort of placements within what we call our regional teams. So within those regional teams, you've got different departments such as immediate land, sales, commercial, technical, production, customer care. And really to be, I think, an effective decision maker in a strategic land function, I think we started off with this basis, you need to have a reasonable understanding of an awful lot of matters as to how the company works. So that grounding in terms of the just spending a little bit of time in each of those departments will certainly pay dividends in terms of actually making sure we're working together. That's one of the sort of key goals within our teams, to make sure we are engaging, whether that's internally or externally. Ultimately, as we say, we want to make sure that in delivering planning consents, we're dealing with that with both a timely manner and also delivering value for the company. We only do that by engaging.
The fight for talent is pretty fierce at the moment. How is Taylor Wimpey ensuring that it gets the best talent and it's going to keep the best talent? Because, there are lots of very entrepreneurial young people out there.
To some degree, that starts with looking at the likes of James, who's now progressed through his sort of 2 year programme, who's been promoted already to an assistant land manager. I'd say at that point, the world's your oyster. If for talented individuals, the company will go out of their way to look after them, to make sure that they have the right opportunities, that they'll go out of the way to actually, if there's an area where we think they need to develop, they'll take them outside of their job and put them in a different environment. I think if you look now at some of the graduates who were brought in to some of the earlier programs, maybe 10 years ago, a number of those now are becoming MDs, We've also got some on the main board. So, I mean, that is testament itself in terms of the commitment from the company.
Great. And what will you ask them in an interview? Presumably you do some of the interviews, Ben?
No, absolutely. I think we're going through the process at the moment in terms of just selecting candidates, as I say. I mean, the key thing for me really is enthusiasm and commitment. I think a lot of the candidates which we see, they will be very rounded in terms of their sort of their academic background, and to some degree, I take that as a necessity in terms of actually selecting a candidate in the first place. But I mean, if you think about how the role develops and what our expectations are. That individual is going to be representing the company in a variety of different formats, whether it's confronted by a landowner, maybe it's a land agent, maybe having to present a planning case to with a local authority or indeed a parish council. So that ability to engage is also absolutely key. But I think it's probably one of the key strengths I'd like to look for in certainly some of my team and prospective team members, is a degree of tenacity as well. I think you quite rightly said that this can be a long, old process sometimes, and it's not always straightforward. It can sometimes take a long time to get deals over the line, and it can take an even longer period of time to actually get your planning permissions through. So that tenacity and the ability to not let things go is a really key factor for me.
All right, I think we've been through everything that Strategic Land at Taylor Wimpey has to offer. Is there anything else you want to add for young listeners
old? I think just as somebody who's come through that graduate role, I think don't get disheartened by if you're applying to different companies and different parts of the industry. I'd just say keep going and keep pursuing the opportunities that you are really interested in. As Ben said, that tenacity from even as early as applying for roles comes across and is great for when you actually get into a role like this and for getting opportunities to progress up in your career. So I think, yeah, just keep going and, I'd say that's the best bit.
Great advice. All right. Ben Coles, James Mallion, thank you very much from Taylor Wimpey, and Alex Peace from EG, thank you very much.